This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm Hilary Harper. I present the Saturday morning program on ABC Radio Melbourne and ABC Radio Victoria. And it's so lovely to be out here in this room tonight with you, fully engaged people, not in a blank radio studio, and with this man beside me, Hisham Attar. When he was 9, his family left Libya. He didn't see it again for 33 years. When he was 19, his father was kidnapped, and his fate is still a mystery. So he's managed to make some beautiful, meditative, rigorous works out of those horrors. Two novels, and now The Return, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Biography and a hot-off-the-press Rathbones Folio Prize as well. It was shortlisted for the Costa Biography Award too, among others. Alan Hollinghurst said it was a masterpiece. Hilary Mantel raved about it. I think Hisham Attar would hope that would shut up about now. Wait till we get to the question about his breakdancing experience from early in life. Please give him a warm welcome. Thank you. Now, I would love to start, if I may, with a little reading from The Return, just to plunge you into the world of this book. Is that all right with you,
Hisham? Yes, absolutely.
Great.
Good evening. It's really lovely to be here, and it's my second time in your city. And thanks also to everybody that has organized this, and you know, down to the people that have set the chairs and put the mics, and it's really, I really appreciate it, and it's a pleasure to be in conversation with you, Hilary. Early morning, March 2012, my mother, my wife Diana, and I were sitting in a row of seats that were bolted to the tiled floor of a lounge in Cairo International Airport. Flight 835 for Benghazi, a voice announced, was due to depart on time. Every now and then, my mother glanced anxiously at me. Diana, too, seemed concerned. She placed a hand on my arm and smiled. I should get up and walk around, I told myself. But my body remained rigid. I had never felt more capable of stillness. The terminal was nearly empty. There was only one man sitting opposite us. He was overweight, weary-looking, possibly in his mid-50s. There was something in the way he sat, the locked hands on the lap, the left tilt of the torso, that signaled resignation. Was he Egyptian or Libyan? Was he on a visit to the neighboring country or going home after the revolution? Had he been for or against Gaddafi? Perhaps he was one of those undecided ones who held their reservations close to their chest. The voice of the announcer returned. It was time to board. I found myself standing at the front of the line, Diana beside me. She had, on more than one occasion, taken me to the town where she was born in Northern California. I know the plants and the color of the light and the distances where she grew up. Now I was, finally, taking her to my land. She had packed the Hasselblad and the Leica, her two favorite cameras, and 100 rolls of film. Diana works with great fidelity. Once she gets hold of a thread, she will follow it until the end. Knowing this excited and worried me. I'm reluctant to give Libya any more than it has already taken. Mother was pacing by the windows that looked onto the runway, speaking on her mobile phone. People, mostly men, began to fill the terminal. Diana and I were now standing at the head of a long line. It bent behind us like a river. I pretended I had forgotten something and pulled her to one side. Returning after all these years was a bad idea, I suddenly thought. My family had left in 1979, 33 years earlier. This was the chasm that divided the man from the 8-year-old boy I was then. The plane was going to cross that gulf. Surely such journeys were reckless. This one could rob me of a skill that I have worked hard to cultivate, how to live away from places and people I love. Joseph Brodsky was right. So were Nabokov and Conrad. They were artists who never returned. Each had tried, in his own way, to cure himself of his country. What you have left behind has dissolved, Return, and you will face the absence or the defacement of what you treasured. But Dmitry Shostakovich and Boris Pasternak and Naguib Mahfouz were also right. Never leave the homeland. Leave, and your connections to the source will be severed. You will be like a dead trunk, hard and hollow. What do you do when you cannot leave and cannot return?
Hisham, at one point in the return, you write that the torment of grief is outside language, and you talk about death having no grammar. How did you manage to construct this book in that space?
I think everything is outside language. I think the things that we all feel and think about don't represent themselves in their essence in language. And then we are finding a way to translate them. And inevitably, it's always an approximation. This is actually both the failure or limitation of language, but it's also what's exciting about it. Because you are forever in that distance, no? Between what the thing is and how it's being expressed. So my book remains an approximation. This is an approximation of how I feel. In fact, it's an approximation of how I felt at a certain moment, because everything is moving, right?
Well, at one point, where you talk about your writing day, you wrote this article where you said it's like if I'm lucky, I get 500 words at the end of the day, and it's like the process is drawing a comb repeatedly through tangled hair until there's not much left.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, I certainly hope, maybe I'm just consoling myself, but I hope I'm not alone in this. I think most, all writers maybe, are involved in something very similar. And maybe the whole, you know, all of the genres, all of the arts are that, aren't they? They're sort of an attempt to travel that distance between what is felt inside and what is outside. In fact, today, earlier on, I was talking to a friend about a passage in Hamlet I just, for whatever reason, on the way here on the airplane, I started rereading Hamlet. And there's that passage, if you remember, when Hamlet's mother is telling him, you know, get over it, you know. you know, your father died, we understand. People die, that's the way of the world. You know, we're all going to die. And he agrees with her. He says, yes, yeah. But she says, it seems particular with you. And he gets caught up. He trips on that word seems. And he says, seems, madam. Nay, it is. I know not seems. It's not only my inky cloak, good mother, nor my custom suit of, nor my suits of custom black, nor my, what's the next one? I'll get it. Hold on, wait. Yes, nor windy suspirations of forced breath, nor the fruitful river in the eye, nor the behavior of the visage, the dejected behavior of the visage, and other forms, moods, shapes of grief that denote me truly. These indeed seem, for they are games that a man can play. But I have that within that passeth shows. These are the trappings and the suits of woe. So this idea that it's not just what you're seeing, that there is something inside that is being expressed clumsily, inaccurately through my behavior and through, is something that I think all art is invested in, you know? I mean, that line of, you know, I have that within that passeth shows, you know, can be a one definition at least of art, you know?
And I was going to ask if it was significant that you were reading Hamlet, which is so much about the lost father and how you go on after that and the recurrence of the father in ways that are significant but not necessarily useful. But then those tropes are everywhere, aren't they? It must be so hard not to see them everywhere being significant to you.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm I'm one of those stuttering readers. You know, I reread. Most of my reading is rereading, just because it's, you know, some of these works are just infinitely interesting.
Well, and what about the language that you write in? Because you talk about Nabokov, and he missed Russian till the end of his life. He kept saying, you know, it was such a docile language. I could do things in it that I couldn't do in English. How does English measure up for you?
Actually, this subject is very connected to your first question, because it is when we say that the nature of language is always involved in translation, that doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't matter, therefore, which language to write in, because language it's got its own attitude, its own character. It invites certain things and, you know, encourages certain things and makes other things less possible. So I think it matters hugely what language you're writing in. And you are... I remember when I was... a teenager, and I found the subject very difficult, just like I think most young people, you're concerned with consolidating things. You know, when you see a contradiction in your life, you want to consolidate it. And I was like that. And I had the good fortune of meeting Naguib Mahfouz, who was as talented as he was kind, that man. He was just such a lovely, lovely man. And he said to me, "You understand that by writing in English, you are writing into that river." And it was hard for me to hear that, because I wanted somehow to, I wanted to consolidate the contradiction. And but he was right, you know. And it was an interesting image, because the language is a river. It has its own ecosystem, its own tides. Just by writing into it, you're already having to somehow respond to everything that has happened in it, right? Especially a mongrel language like English that is so porous, you know. One of its wonderful facilities, its agility, you know, its ability to sort of absorb so much. So it welcomes people who want to bend things and, you know, change things. So you know, that's so. But these contradictions that at one point I wanted to consolidate, now I'm just interested in them. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's the pleasure of middle age, but I think our societies really fetishize youth. That sometimes we forget that there are some endless pleasures to being, you know, in your mid-40s. It's fantastic on some level, because you know yourself better, and you also can exercise your enthusiasms and your curiosities about the things that used to trouble you somehow.
And what I found fascinating about reading your novels and then reading The Return was how you write so evocatively about the state of being a child as well as the state of being an adult in different stages. Would you mind reading the first paragraph here where Nuri is swimming and thinking of his father?
Yes, of course. This is my first book.
We are very kind.
Yes. No, I say that with a hint of pleasure.
Good.
That night I dreamed of Baba floating on the sea. The water was unsettled, moving as it does in the deep, rising and falling in hills. He lay on his back. He looked like a small fishing boat trying to surrender to the sea. I was there too, working hard to keep my shoulders above water, to not lose sight of him. But the sea rose and he vanished from view. I kept swimming. I knew I was close. Then I saw him, wooden and stiff. When I reached out to touch him, he turned into a fish, agile and shy. Plunged with a splash down and away. I could see his silver spine flicker below the water. I turned around and saw no shore to return to.
The novels are just soaked in that sense of loss for fathers in various stages of disappearance and types of disappearance. Why did you decide now that the return was the form that you needed for this story?
You know, the interesting thing is that I don't think I've ever decided anything, really. I've never decided what book to write. I mean, I think there is actually a range. There is a choice, and the choice is not to write it. But I don't feel, at least with me, I don't feel that there is a choice of which book to write. Books start with, they start in ways that are not, they're certainly not deliberate. They don't, at least don't seem that way. I get implicated into them by usually a sentence or an image or a feeling sometimes. And I try to find words into that space. And then the whole thing starts to accumulate. And then something really quite fascinating happens that, if I'm to be really honest, is at the heart of the pleasure I find in this work, where a book starts to become a presence in your days that employs you. It curates your interests. It focuses your enthusiasms. And the book starts to have its own attitude, really, its own tastes, its own preoccupations. And it needs absolutely everything you've got. Your intellect, your psychological life, your emotional knowledge, everything that you know and that you are, your sensibility. And that's... maybe it's perverse, but there's a particular pleasure to being totally employed by your work. And so that's sort of a very quick impression of how these things evolve. They're not really a choice. And with the return, I don't know in the beginning whether I welcomed the invitation by the book, because
the job offer.
Yes, I really, you know, because it felt like a tunnel, felt like I was entering a tunnel, and as all my friends know, I hate tunnels. I'm very claustrophobic, and it was a tunnel that I wasn't sure has another, you know, has an end. And I felt as though I had to somehow I have to remember my steps, because there might be the need to return and get out. But that was just in the beginning. Once the book started to impose its own authority, it became thrilling. This is the paradox. You know, the material is very close to me. It's very, very. A lot of it is incredibly painful and heavy. And it was asking me, the book, to be incredibly patient about things that I am terribly impatient about. You know. But once it started to impose its authority, I found the act of working on it thrilling, mainly because it always felt to have its appetites felt always greater than my own. You know, its abilities. I used to be a keen horseback rider, and so working on it, I kept seeing this horse. You know, because I remember when I used to ride horses, you had to be careful what horse to partner with, because when they exceed your abilities, it's very unpleasant and embarrassing situation. And so, but this horse felt that way. It was always egging me on, saying, you know, you want to canter? Oh, I can canter. You want to wade through rivers? You want to climb? You want to gallop? Come on, step up, you know. Every day it was saying that, and that's, you know, that is a thrill.
Okay. Were you worried that writing the book would change your memories? They've done research, apparently, that says that writing memoir can have this revolutionary effect on one's sense of self, because you're putting a narrative onto you. Were you worried about the effects it might have?
That's a very good question. No, and also it didn't somehow... The surprise was that you know, when I was set, when I was, as it were, to use the same word again, implicated into the book, I started to think about it and think about what else it might contain. And there's a lot of material that didn't go in there. So it felt in the beginning, the anxiety in the beginning was the anxiety of a greedy fisherman. You cast the net, and the point is that you catch all the fish in the sea. And then slowly, slowly, you are, you know, humbled into the position of wanting to catch just one fish. And so it is, of course, about my memories and about the past, but it is also it's an artistic exercise that is really not about my life at all on some level. I don't know how to describe that. Because the absurd thing is that I am not essentially interested in my life. You know? I'm not interested essentially in myself or in my country or in, I mean, I always think other people are far more interesting. But it's through these experiences that I have been indoctrinated, just like the rest of us. I've been educated in a small way about what it might be to be a human being. What is our relationship to the past, our relationship to one another, our relationship to grief, to history, to love, no? And I use the particulars of my life in order to tap into those things that I'm excited about. And why am I excited about them? I think because on some level I haven't gotten over the fact that I'm a human being, you know. To me, it's the most amazing thing.
Even middle age, it's not cured it's, you.
All of it. It's just miraculous. Really is. You know, I wouldn't choose to be anything else. It's really wondrous, you know. And my attitude a bit to it is a bit like those landscape painters, you know. It's sort of my fervor or my enthusiasm arises from nature, really. That's sort of where I am. So of course I'm using my memories, but I'm not necessarily interested in my memories.
But there's so many points within the book where there's this amazing resonance between you describing what's going on in you or in your family and the greater Libyan story. There was one particularly that struck me when you talked about, you know, the effect of that massive rupture of your father disappearing at 19 and also previously of having to leave Libya when you were 9 and then meeting the ex-prisoners, your relatives who were released, and that sense that they carried within them this youthfulness because they had been stopped at the point where they'd gone into prison.
Yes.
And meeting them when they were 20 years older. And I wonder if you would care to elaborate on that parallel.
Yeah, no, that's a very good observation. I mean, I've... you know, returning, here the return, I discovered as I was working on it. There are two things that are peculiar in working on this book. The first is that it's the same title as it was from the first sentence I started, no? So it's the title, and that's not the case normally with me. Normally I'm very mischievous with my titles and change until I settle on one. And the other thing is that I wrote it pretty much in the order that you've read it in, you know, that, and that's also unusual for me. But the sense that I the meaning in that title, meaning in the return, expanded as I worked. So in the beginning, it was just a literal. Title, me going back to Libya after 33 years of not going there. And then as I was working, I realized that there are other hidden meanings in it, you know, that I was also in a sense returning to, as I mentioned in the passage that I read, the places and the people that I love, but also returning to, a more fuller conception or perspective on who I am, the distances that I've crossed, the things that I've become in those 33 years. Because I think the fallacy or the myth that sometimes exiles can fall into is that, you know, you leave and you are the same and the country is the same, and at some point in the distance, you'll be reunited. And of course, none of us are ever the same. We are changing. All the points are moving. You are moving, the country is moving, and your memories of the country also are like the nature of memory. They're evolving and expanding and being continually informed by what happens in the present. So all of that was changing. And so I somehow returned to a fuller sense of that, you know. And also, the other one, of course, is that I was returning to find my father, who was a political prisoner who had disappeared. And in a sense, I was returning to that very powerful preoccupation that has authored or certainly marked half of my life, you know, looking for my father, the last 25 years of my life. And so it was also a return to that in some way. But this is a very long way to answer your question, because when I went there, had you asked me before, did you see things this way, did you see Libya as a kind of target where somehow you'd get there and things would be resolved? I'd say, no, that's of course very silly, because I know from life nothing is ever resolved. That's what's interesting about it. Things are always, you know, unfolding. But when I arrived in Libya, I realized that I had cultivated subconsciously this fantasy of the stowaway who's going to see this island called Libya, and will arrive at the island and all existential questions will be resolved. And of course, I arrived there and my arrival expanded my sense of the distances that I've crossed, no? So, and I could see the different selves, you know. I could see the self when I was, a child in Libya, but also the self that grew outside and in Britain, and it grew inside the English language, too. So it was also the two languages, you know, coming together. Yeah.
And it's interesting how there's the deeply affecting personal story, and there's also the terrifying encounters with the elements of the Libyan regime and the kind of forensic discussion of how that goes. That is, those are amazing passages. I wanted to ask, if you don't mind, in the novels, it sometimes feels like the young male protagonists are getting into situations where they're almost taking revenge on the absent father. I mean, Suleiman comes very close to risking a terrible betrayal, and Nuri desires his stepmother. And I'm wondering if this is a fear that haunts the son of a disappeared father, that it's somehow something he did as a child that has caused this disappearance, because that's such a powerful story that we tell about fathers and sons.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know. It's such an intelligent proposition. I find it very difficult to think of the novels in that way, of the work in general in that way. But you know, I always thought that that story of Oedipus is so interesting, because What on some level it's really about is the very strange distance that exists between a father and a son, and the fact that our fathers seem incredibly intimate but totally unknowable. You know, it's very difficult to come at one's father as an equal. It's very difficult to imagine that. And whenever the veil lifts for a minute and you see them as an equal, it's more often than not, it's an unsettling moment. There's a line in Anatomy of a Disappearance, my second novel, where the protagonist says, you know, the best way to win an argument is you disappear, right? So you're also left with all the things that we all have to contend with, right? And I write about this in The Return, that, you know, when your father has disappeared, all of the natural instincts for rebellion become complicated. You're on some level made impotent by the disappearance. and you have to find a way to negotiate your own way. And so I've been interested in the different stages of my responses to this, and I try to look at them in the return. How, for example, in my father disappeared when I was 19, so my 20s were a very complicated stage in my life. You know, I always, maybe please tell me it's a fantasy and your 20s are exactly the same. I hope not, actually. No, I'll be, but that my, you know, I always think of the 20s at the moment when you are sort of full of action and breaking into the world and facing forward. And I wasn't like that at all. I was, you know, in fact, I used to have a reoccurring dream in my 20s that I must have had about, you know, 3 or 4 times over that decade. But it never left me. It's a very powerful dream of me walking very much as I am, you know, as I was in my 20s. Walking, but I'm disfigured. My head is facing the opposite direction. And my Adam's apple is the uppermost punctuation of my spine. Otherwise, everything else is exactly the same. The feeling in the dream is that I've somehow neglected something, that it was my fault, that it wasn't, that I had overlooked something, you know. And I think it's, you know, strangely, a very accurate representation of my 20s, because I was this man who was looking back all the time at trying to find what happened, what, you know, where might he be, right?
I'm wondering, I was reminded of an amazing conversation that you report between within your family. So your mother and you and your brother are trying to dissuade your father from some of his activities, and he says something incredible to you that really highlights that the problem of the nation versus the home. Yeah. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, he says, don't ever put yourself in competition with Libya because you will always lose. And, you know, my father was committed to a cause. It was very clear that the cause was the most important thing. This is not as simple as saying he didn't care for his family. He very much loved his family. He was a very loving and thoughtful and generous and kind man. But the two were somehow mixed up, because he also thought that the cause, you know, a better Libya, would benefit his family as well, not only his children but the children of the country. So it was a complicated situation. But you're right. I mean, that was the moment when one of the moments when you could see a moment of national preoccupation infiltrating intimacies. And this is something that I think runs through all my work, that I've been touched by that, but I'm also interested in that. You know, I'm interested in the nature of intimacy in general, you know, and the things that filter through in it.
And there are wonderful moments in the book of connection and affection over, you know, coffee and cigarettes and pastries and beautiful intimate family times. But then you bring in elements sometimes, for example, your relationship with your cousin Marwan, who has to leave the room out of fear every time the regime is denounced because he's so terrified at the power of it to infiltrate those spaces.
And yes,
you make a wonderful point there about the corrupting factor.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm wondering if your search for your father, which went on for so many years and you know, is still alive, it would have been different if you had had less respect for him, if he'd been more of an ordinary guy, less revered in the country.
I like to think not. I don't know. I mean, it's you know, it's very isn't it the case that, you know, that things are structured in such a way in our intimate lives that if you were to move one piece, things might change. You know, I don't know, but I very much policed my admiration for my father, by which I mean that I wanted to keep him real, and you know, and also you know, I admire my father, but I also had my criticisms, and we had very passionate arguments that I write about in the book, arguments that I that were passionate but were also interesting and gave us delight, you know. But my father had this very interesting idea about what a conversation might be. So he, because I was very argumentative when I was young, and I was very good at it. I was one of those irritating, debating boys. You know, I could debate the hell out of anything. So, and he spotted this. And so he wanted to, and I think rightly and intelligently, complicate it, no? Trick me out of this strange paradigm of just winning an argument for the sake of it. And he said to me, so, how about this as a proposition for what an interesting conversation might be? You bring your proposal, I bring mine, and then together, instead of beating each other with these proposals until one of us wins, how about if we together go and try to find a third proposition? There may be even a fourth. So conversation as a creative kind of endeavor, you know? So when I say we had these passionate arguments, they were, you know, in that way, but they were often about the politics and about, we agreed, of course, on the main lines, you know, we had, you know, very similar ideas about, you know, about politics. And but we disagreed on the method. How do you then make this possible? And the disagreement was, of course, intellectual, but it was also mainly very personal. I wanted him to do the things that, you know, wouldn't put him in danger, right? I mean, just like I think all children, you at their moment, I would doubt that anybody in on this planet has never felt this, you know, that the moment in your childhood when you look at your parents and you think, these people obviously have no clue. They obviously don't know how to take care of themselves, and I must step in.
When you last spoke at the Wheeler Centre, which is a wonderful talk actually, and it's still online if you want to have a listen, you said that you were an inappropriate place for us to put our pity, that we should instead pity the sons of the villains in the piece, of the people in Libya who had done these terrible damages. Do you still feel that way?
I do, yes. I mean, I take it to heart, you know, when... you know, it's I take it to heart, of course, when people I've never met before feel a sincere and honest sympathy for this complicated, difficult fate. No, I take it to heart. I know it's well intended, and it touches me. But so it's not for a minute me rejecting that, or but it's more opening up that space, you know, to for us to think more about it, you know, because on the face of it, of course, this is very difficult. You lose your father; he's disappeared. You don't know where he is, how his last days were, when exactly did he die? Not knowing when exactly he died is a complicated thing. Where his remains might be, etc. This is not something easy or something I would wish on anyone. Having said that, it is very convenient being my father's son. It's very easy, you know. He was lovely, and he was honorable. He was, you know, he for whatever reason, as he says in one of his prison letters, for whatever reason, I was able to resist injustice. I was able to stand and oppose it, you know, something. He had some strength that allowed him to do that. And it's an accident, isn't it? I mean, who we are born into. It's a complete accident. So it's very lucky on that level. And I say that not to pat myself on the back or congratulate myself or congratulate my father. I say that more to myself, in order to inspire and encourage in me a compassion, a sense of curiosity, a sense of honest, respectful sympathy for the other son, the son of the man who tortured my father, the son of the man who betrayed his cause or killed or raped or did the worst things that we can imagine. Because what that does, therefore, it sort of, it does the opposite of the intended effect of the violent act. I think every violent act has implicit in it a desire to narrow the imagination, narrow the heart. And so what you do then is you expand. You know, you continue to remind yourself that, you know, what is incredibly amazing and should be taken with infinite seriousness in the enterprise of being a human being is that we are all really brothers and sisters. The similarities between us are far greater than the differences. And this should be a source of curiosity and enthusiasm in engaging with the business of being alive, no? So that's I say it from that. Because of that sort of instinct. So when I said it really as me speaking to myself, you know. Yeah.
I salute you for being able to continue feeling that way, even having text message conversations with Saif al-Islam, during which he sends you just outrageously. I lose the words, you know. Yeah. He has no idea or no caring for how the effect of what he's doing.
Yeah, no, that was one of the most difficult things I've ever done, really, you know. And in hindsight, I don't, you know, if I were speaking to my, you know, if I were, as we all are, the parents of our younger selves, no, I would sort of, I don't know, maybe that was a little bit, you're risking a little bit too much, expecting too much of yourself. But we were playing a very dangerous game. He wanted me to somehow, you know, to come to Libya, to be photographed with him, and this is a fantastic PR coup. The son of a dissident, arguably the most vocal. Son of a dissident, only because of my work and the access it gave me to the media, you know, returns and is chums with the dictator's son. That's a fantastic coup. This is a regime that was spending a lot of money on PR agencies in Britain and in New York and even in Australia. They hired people here, so they were serious about this project. What I wanted, it was obvious, I wanted to secure the whereabouts of my father, whether he's alive or dead. And this was the game we were playing. He was never going to tell me, and I was never going to go. But neither of us got what we wanted. But why it was dangerous is I had far more to lose than he did. Because in my position, the most precious thing is your position, is your stance, no? The other reason why it was dangerous is he was far better experienced and practiced in this. The Libyan regime was very successful in acquiring, buying, you know, breaking people like me. So it was, you know, I put myself in a slightly precarious position. And he always made it clear to me that he knew. He had the information. He knew what had happened to my father, but he won't tell me until I do this or do that. And I learned, really, the genius and accuracy of international law, because international law deems disappearance as an act of torture, not only towards the person who's been made to disappear, but towards their family. And I think here is really the true genius of the law. It's also an act of torture to the people who have been ordered to disappear the person, no? So that was what was going on.
We'll open up to questions in just a moment, so look out for the people with the microphones if you'd like to put your hand up in a minute. But I just wanted to recall a poem that you cited by, is it Khaled Matawa?
Yes.
Because people are so often exhorted to look ahead when a regime falls in order to rebuild together. And his poem, After 42 Years, included the line, "I was five when the dictator took my brother away. Over now, 42 years, must look ahead." Can you do that? Is that actually possible? Or is there a way that we're kind of... Should we be harnessed to the dead and disappeared still?
Well, I don't know. I think it must be both, you know, on some level. I think that the present is always a symptom of everything else that has happened in the past. That's and it's both. It's a complicated symptom, the present. The present is not a symptom in the sense that it's just a passive representation of the past. Because, of course, we are contributing to it, and we can turn it, and we can, change some things, at least. So it's also the symptom of the past and the author of the future. You know, so it's a, and I think one needs that kind of depth of engagement with moments like this in any country's life, in any individual's life. You know, to be able to hold all those things is not always possible, but I think it's got to be both. You know? Yeah.
Do we have questions for Hisham Mattar?
Thank you, Hisham. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but I'll do the best I can. I'm very struck by the quiet, measured, almost serene tone of your book, even though it deals with some really grim subject matter. And I'm wondering, you've spoken about writing in English. I'm wondering if your knowledge of Arabic and the poetry of your father and the poetry of the Arab people has somehow informed that tone in your book.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I think what I was interested in the book, and this might be behind your observation, that I'm not really motivated by either condemning or in other words, the work is not driven, or at least I wasn't driven by the desire to satisfy my own personal opinions or it is a space for my consciousness. So it's a space. I think maybe all works of art are like that. You know, they're an opportunity for different sides of your consciousness to somehow engage with the world, and so I wanted to create a space where all the loud things and the quiet things can exist, because oftentimes this kind of experience where you can't go back to your country, your father is made to disappear, members of your family are put in prison, other things I don't mention in here, friends of mine that were killed by the regime, the accumulative effect of that is that you feel as though you're drowning, as though history's got you by the neck and is pushing you down, and you can then not think of much else. But if you're like me and you're interested in books and interesting in paintings, and it complicates that. So I remember even when my father was around, during those times of that's the subject. No, the subject is the changing the country, and it becomes complicated to look at a painting. To stand in front of a painting is not a straightforward act in the best of times. But with that, it becomes so the book then becomes a space where all of that can come to the surface. The loud things, the terrible things that have happened, but also the subtle ways that it affects human relations and intimacies, and also the books, the paintings that have been such a big part of my life and feel like companions to me. All of that demanded a certain kind of what I mentioned earlier, a sort of sense of patience, kind of sort of staying with something. And what I found is that when I would look, not as the person, but as the artist, as the writer, because the person wanted to run out of the tunnel all the time, but the writer was having a good time. And so, as a writer, when I would look at something very difficult, a particular moment that I really would rather not look at all, But if I looked at it in a certain way, if I looked at it without intention, in other words, without wanting it to do something for me, or without wanting it to somehow be resolved or be a cathartic, you know, endeavor or to prove a point, if I tried to stay at that place where I was having a gentle but persistent curiosity towards it that was inspired by, you know, in what way it might be connected to you as well, right? And if I looked at it long enough that way, something began to happen. Something began to open up, you know, in the ideas in it. And I felt it in the writing itself. So those are some of the things that come to mind when I hear you. But thank you. I mean, I'm not saying it, you know, it, I have succeeded in doing that, but it pleases me to hear that you thought that.
Yeah, like the Jews who disappeared and the people under Stalin, was a moment when, looking back, you think your father could have escaped, but just stayed one day too long?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Like when the Jews got, you know, disappeared, like under Hitler, and people disappeared under Stalin, was there a day, looking back, when you feel your father could have escaped, but just stayed too long?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, we thought that at some point, but you know, through the laws of deduction, really, it's clear, at least to me, that my father is not alive.
There were lots of confusing stories coming through too, weren't there, at various points, and it's an amazing reconstructive work too. I think we've got another couple of questions. Yeah.
Thank you, Hisham. I'm really interested in what you were saying about translation and language.
Hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I presume your books have been translated into Arabic?
Yes.
And did you have any input into that, and how do you feel about the resulting translation?
Yes, I have worked closely with the translators, by which I mean, I read the text and made notes, sat with them, and we talked about some of the notes that I had. I have to admit, I find it very difficult. It's not. It's sort of. I somehow had, again, speaking of fantasies, I had a fantasy that the text will return to Arabic. But I discovered through these engagements with the translation that I am really an English language writer. My ear, my enthusiasms, my sensitivities belong to that language. And so as pleasurable as it is working with any translation, just because it is a true privilege to be translated, it was very, very, you know, it was a corruption also. It felt like which is a completely different text, you know. What Javier Maria says about his translations is, he says, you know, none of the words in that book were chosen by me, you know. So that's, you know, that's sort of, that's both what's problematic and what's really endlessly interesting about translation, and why our culture really needs to step up in its appreciation of translators and pay them properly and treat them as what they are, artists, you know. But to go to another place about this issue of translation, I find something else that it's a little bit harder to talk about, but I think it's paradoxically the most interesting thing, maybe, when we talk about prose. And it's the quality of silence that any author must author around the prose. And we feel it as readers. You read a book and you could feel a certain quality of silence around this book that is a little bit different from that one. Slightly louder silence, a slightly quieter silence, more expansive one, a shallow one. Because as we know from our lives, not two silences are the same. You know, the silence of you being in the car alone is not like the silence with you being in the car with your mother, or if your mother is asleep, right? So that quality of being is silence is a shorthand for that, is the quality of being that prose can. And sometimes I think, in my fantasy, I think, of a mischievous historian, if there are indeed historians in the hereafter, and if there is indeed a hereafter at all, right? But a mischievous historian might suggest that the entire history of all of the human languages and the efforts of linguistics and all of our literatures were just a mere attempt to say something a little bit greater than silence. Because I think the most powerful things that are communicated in our relationships, at least I speak for myself, the way that I feel towards my wife, towards my friends, towards my mother, towards my brother, I will never find words for them, those emotions. But they are perceived in certain moments in our silences together, you know. So I think that's another form of translation that I also find interesting. Yeah. I haven't answered the question at all.
But the journey was wonderful.
My question is also follows on and is about language. The Jungian analyst James Hillman's written a book called The Terrible Love of War. Mm. And he talks about the situation in the Middle East, going back a long way, but he says that the communication is flawed by the fact that, on the one hand, English is very dynamic but essentially prosaic language, whereas Arabic is essentially poetic. I wondered, one, if you agree with that, and two, if you think that affects your own writing, and three, if you might venture into seeing how that might be relevant in understanding the contemporary Middle East.
So with 3 minutes left.
I wouldn't say they are essentially that. You know, they're both great languages, capable of both, you know, poetics and the prosaic. You know, they're both have many different colors. There is a problem, I feel, with contemporary Arabic that is more to do with the situation of education, of the nature of publishing, it's a symptom of a socio-political reality, that it has, it's not being oxygenated enough, you know, through interaction with it, and this is a serious issue, hard to speak about briefly, but no, I don't think essentially these two languages are different in that way. They are different, of course, because their histories are different. You see, in Arabic, a couple of years ago, I thought it would be interesting to read the three Abrahamic books as a trilogy. You know, start with the Torah, the Bible, and the Quran. I just thought I've read them all before, but I thought I'd read them as if they were written by the same, like they were a trilogy. You know, just read.
What order did you read them in?
In chronological order, and they're very interesting. They're really interesting. But the miracles of proof in the Torah and in the Bible are not linguistic. The miracles of proof are Moses on the mountain and the healing power of Christ and the miraculous birth. You know, those are the ways by which you prove the miracle of proof in the Quran is the language. It is the language is excessively, by miles, incredible. So what that has done to the Arabic language is that it has had connected it to a very powerful grammatical source, and the rules all come from that book. That's both a source of energy to the language, but it's also makes it difficult to modernize it. You know, and there have been many wonderful Arabic writers that have gone miles in doing that. But that I think is why sometimes the Arabic feels like this incredibly stately, symmetric, you know, building, and English is more of a deconstructivist Zaha Hadid building.
Apparently there was some discussion in the 18th century of it making an academy anglaise to set the language like they did in France. I'm right. So pleased they never got that off the ground. And I'm so pleased that we could have all been here tonight so that Hisham Attar could illuminate some of his silences for us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.